You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 17th of May 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up...
Rocket fire from Hamas continued overnight against cities and communities in southern Israel, although for the first time in four nights, residents of the centre of the country, in Tel Aviv, spent one night in which they did not have to go to bomb shelters.
We'll have the latest on a weekend of deadly violence in Israel and Palestine and ask what can be done to bring about a truce between the protagonists. Also ahead, we head to New York City, where Monocle's Henry V. Sheridan will be unpacking the Democratic Party's mayoral race. Plus, we celebrate the return of hugging and touching in England and Scotland as parts of the UK continue to ease pandemic restrictions. And we hear from the Lithuanian band The Roop, one of the hot favourites to win this year's Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah, this scene is really strong in Lithuania. I would, you know, refrain from trying to put, you know, ourselves in music style or any other band into a music style.
That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. And we'll begin straight away with the continuing violence in the Middle East, as the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warns there is no end in sight to the hostilities in Israel and Gaza. In an interview with CBS yesterday evening, Mr. Netanyahu added that we will do whatever it takes to restore order and quiet. It will take some time, he's warned. And all the while, civilians on both sides are dying, with officials in Gaza claiming Sunday was the deadliest day yet. And Israel's army says Palestinian militants have fired more than 3,000 rockets over the past week. Well, Alison Kaplan-Sommer is a journalist at the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. She sent us this report from Tel Aviv.
Israel and Hamas continued unrelenting fire overnight on Sunday with no sign of a ceasefire in sight. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared Sunday evening at the opening of the Shavuot Jewish religious holiday that, quote, we are still in the midst of this operation. It is not over and it will continue for as long as necessary. Indeed, overnight, Israel carried out extensive attacks against Gaza on what they called terror targets. They hit the homes of Hamas commanders as well as underground tunnels, along with a military intelligence compound, according to the Israeli army. According to the Palestinian media, last night's attacks were larger in scale compared to recent days. Earlier on Sunday, Prime Minister Netanyahu said that the attack on a high-rise building in Gaza, which hosted several news organizations, was, quote, perfectly legitimate, as news agencies demanded explanations for the attack. Rocket fire from Hamas also continued overnight against cities and communities in southern Israel, although for the first time in four nights, residents of the center of the country, in Tel Aviv, spent one night in which they did not have to go to bomb shelters. Meanwhile, diplomatic efforts to end the fighting continued. Egyptian President al-Sisi called for an end to the violence between Hamas and Israel, saying that Egypt is working on bringing a ceasefire. American President Joe Biden also made a public statement saying that his administration is working with Palestinians and Israelis towards a sustained calm. In a video marking the Muslim holiday of Eid, Biden said that the U.S. believes, quote, Palestinians and Israelis equally deserve to live in safety and security and enjoy an equal measure of freedom, prosperity, and democracy. Biden made the statement as U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary for Israel and Palestinian Affairs, Hadi Amar, is in Israel meeting with Israeli counterparts discussing the situation. But again, there is no immediate talk of a ceasefire in sight.
Well, that was Alison Kaplan-Sommer in Tel Aviv. Let's explore this further now with Dr. Ataf Al-Shaya, who's a lecturer in Arabic and Cultural Studies at the University of Westminster in London. Ataf is originally from Palestine. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Let's just briefly look again at this weekend. It was the authorities in Gaza are saying that at least it was yesterday was the bloodiest day yet, with, what, 40 people dying?
Yes, absolutely. It was more than 40 people, actually. And I think that if we take into consideration the latest bombing in Gaza last night, which was the most extensive and widespread, there are likely to be more victims, unfortunately.
Let's look at the situation here. We have the Israeli Prime Minister saying that his country's military operation will continue with full force. Yet Hamas is now effectively portraying itself as a defender of Palestinian protesters. We have two sides which are just no closer to being brought together, no matter what the likes of Egypt can do.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to bridge the gap between, I mean, they're not really both sides. I mean, Israel has the heavy hand here using bombardment, and which is very heavy and very extensive and in very densely populated areas. So I don't think it can be equated, but obviously Hamas is firing rockets from Gaza, and many Palestinians view that as a legitimate resistance, because how else would they be able to defend themselves in the face of Israeli occupation and in the face of constant Israeli aggression that has not stopped before this episode of fighting and for a very long time, unfortunately, now.
There are news reports of an offer of an end to this, for the moment at least. Hamas, through Egypt, as Alison said a moment ago, has offered a ceasefire. Israel has rejected this, but in private there is a suggestion that senior Israeli officers are talking about ending their offensive. What do we know about that?
I mean, my understanding that Israel, from reading Israeli media and reports from Israel, is that the military establishment and the media in Israel, they suggest that Israel has not been able to get what it wants, which is basically initially it was about destroying Hamas, which is actually impossible in this case, Hamas being in Gaza, densely populated, etc. And to this end, they have been trying to scale down the ambitions that they have, which is what they're saying, to restore calm to Israel. And because they haven't been able to get anywhere in Gaza, because they're bombing mainly civilian infrastructure, roads, power, electricity, water, basic necessities that basically will deprive Gazans even more and make them even more deprived than they have already been. So I think the efforts so far have not been successful to get to an end, mainly because of Netanyahu's arrogance and to cling on and to show himself as powerful and forceful in Israeli politics and to cling on. So I think much of that is motivated by him not agreeing to any ceasefire offer, mainly because to show the Israelis that he's a strong man who can bring security back to Israel, which doesn't look like it now and for the future as well.
It is a difficult situation for Mr. Netanyahu, given the fact that about a week ago it looked like he was just about to lose his job, but now he is being the strong man of Israel, and he finds that actually it's quite politically difficult for him to agree a ceasefire, doesn't it? Because his supporters are in the areas which are being most intensely targeted. I'm thinking about Ashkelon.
Yes, I mean, I think it's, he started the whole thing up in Jerusalem in the first place in order to create a situation which is to cling on to power in Israel. And so far, it seems to be working in his favor there. But Israeli politics seems to be quite complex, and they might go for another round of elections. The Israelis might see that he has not brought them peace, being in power for more than 12 years now, and it doesn't look like peace is anywhere near Israel. Therefore, they might. But based the Israeli establishment and the whole narrative and culture is based on around military power and militarization farther and farther, and it's very much antagonistic towards the Palestinian. There has not been any offer of peace of any concrete nature. And that's where the Israeli sort of establishment in general, and the Israeli sort of media and narrative in general is. But for Netanyahu, he seems to be the winning figure now, and I don't see this changing anytime soon.
Let's talk a little bit about external influences. We've had efforts by Egypt to try to broker some sort of ceasefire. The UN Security Council held a meeting, an emergency meeting yesterday, with the Secretary General Antonio Guterres, warning that further fighting could plunge the region into an uncontainable crisis. What does he mean by that?
Well, I mean, so far it is already really deep in a crisis, particularly in Gaza. So many civilians, mainly civilians, have died. I mean, there are tens of women, children, you know, people who are completely not involved in any sort of fighting or anything. And the indiscriminate bombing that took place, for example, yesterday near the hospital of Al-Shifa, which is the main hospital in Gaza, it means that more of this kind of violence, it means actually the situation in Gaza will completely get out of hand, more than it already is. And it could spiral into more refugees, more crisis, food crisis that the United Nations cannot cope with the infrastructure that has been damaged already in Gaza. So I think that that's perhaps what he meant by that, that more war will just lead to more suffering. And then also there is no diplomatic solution that can come at the back of with this situation being what it is, which is war and destruction and suffering that is unnecessary and that doesn't lead to any opening as far as, you know, calm and stability to Gaza is concerned. And that's perhaps what he meant by that.
We also have the Israelis saying that 3,000 rockets have been fired back into Israel in the last week, which is making life there unbearable for many people who are living with hourly air raid sirens. And we also have the complication that most Western powers, including the United States, won't talk to Hamas because this is it's considered to be a terrorist organization.
Yeah, I mean, this situation does exist, but it's also the fact that really Gazans have been under severe siege for a very, very long time. They don't see any hope in this changing anytime soon. Hamas offered the ceasefire. Hamas also offered, before this round of fighting started, that to Israel, to give Israel a chance to withdraw from Al-Aqsa, to stop the stunt grenade against, you know, people praying in Al-Aqsa, to stop the eviction, or actually the ethnic cleansing, more like in East Jerusalem. So there were some of this sort, but this has not happened, and therefore the Palestinians feel under pressure, and I think their resistance is born of their suffering more than anything else. I wouldn't read too much ideology into it just for destruction's sake. Obviously, any deaths are unfortunate and so on. That's always sad and tragic, really, to everyone. But I do think understanding the underlying causes and structure of the conflict is very necessary to get a broader and deeper understanding of the entire conflict. So it is unfortunate, but that's what it is, mainly because of the suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and even inside Israel itself. So this discrimination and apartheid, which has been recognized by many international organizations, including the Israeli organization Beit Salem, a human rights organization, has to end so that we can get somewhere out of this cycle of violence and bloodshed that the Palestinians have been paying the heaviest of a brunt as a result of it, unfortunately.
But who from the Palestinian side can the West talk to if they can't talk to Hamas, and Mahmoud Abbas has very little influence over Hamas in Gaza? There is no one that actually someone can directly say, we need to sit down and talk about this.
It's part of the problem, because Hamas is part of the Palestinian people. It's not like, you know, they are aliens who have come from nowhere. This is really is part of a long-running problem. And I think many Europeans behind the scenes, and even Americans recently, recognize this. They understand that Hamas has power. They are in Gaza. They are in the West Bank. They are also part of the society. And trying to portray them as just terrorists, as sort of like Al-Qaeda or sort of those Islamist sort of organizations that were destructive and so on, beyond the nation state boundaries, and not understanding the underlying cause of the occupation that leads to the violence in the first place, is really a major problem. So I think talking to Hamas, which I think many European diplomats and officials understand, but unfortunately there have also been lobbies and Israeli lobby, and which is very powerful in the state. But I think there is a shift and there is a change in discourse in certain quarters in the United States, as well as here in Europe. And hopefully that will give rise to a new approach, because clearly the approach of not talking to Hamas, freezing them out from any conversation when they have power, when they are in Gaza, when they are part of the Palestinian society and part of the Palestinian politics. And the dynamics of politics between Hamas and Fatah is very similar to many dynamics in the Arab world in terms of an Islamic movement versus sort of secular movement. And these also have to be explained as categories. But we don't have time for here. So talking to them is an essential step towards understanding what's happening, what are the grievances, how they can be dealt with, rather than just portraying Hamas and reducing it to terrorism, while excusing Israel for clearly, you know, human rights violations and abuses and crimes of such magnitude that are really terrifying.
Dr. Atef Al-Shea, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. 8:16 in Zurich, 7:16 here in London. Now, at the end of last week, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, told Russia's Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, that the White House won't hesitate in responding to aggression from Moscow. The US State Department stressed President Biden's resolve to protect US citizens and act firmly in defense of US interests in response to actions by Russia that harm us or our allies. So it is these rather stressed circumstances that set the scene for Secretary of State Blinken and Foreign Minister Lavrov's meeting this week at the Arctic Council in Iceland. Well, I'm joined by Elizabeth Brawl, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institution, economist for foreign policy and a regular voice. Good morning, Elizabeth. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Emma.
So just tell us what happened in a little more detail between Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov last week in this phone call.
Yeah, so they were preparing for this meeting of the Arctic Council, which is about to take place. And people may say, well, what the Arctic Council, what's that about? That doesn't sound very important at all. Actually, this group of nations, Arctic nations, are it's a format that has been in place since 1996 now, and it's very useful when Russia and the US, as it happens, can't talk in any other formats. They can't talk at NATO. It's troubled. There's a troubled relationship between them at the UN. So now this meeting of the Arctic Council came along very conveniently. It was scheduled anyway, and they will be discussing, as the Russian side has put out in a statement, they will be discussing tactical issues in the Arctic. But it's also an opportunity for Blinken and Lavrov to talk about more strategic issues, simply because there aren't many other formats available to them at the moment.
Indeed. I mean, but the issues that they have to deal with are high in number and deep in seriousness. I mean, we have the Russian dispatch of troops to the border with Ukraine. We still have allegations of Russian meddling in the US elections. And we also have the cyber attack on the US oil pipeline last week. Huge things that in individual circumstances would be enormous. But, you know, Antony Blinken has got an enormous list to sort of like place at Lavrov's door and say, right, explain yourselves.
Yes, and there is only so much you can discuss at a meeting about the Arctic, but nevertheless, he will be able to articulate some of these issues. We should remember that the dark side attack on Continental Pipeline in the US was by a criminal group, so I think there's not very much Blinken will be able to discuss with Lavrov about it, even though dark side is a Russian group. But the point is that at least they will be sitting together at the table, and that's a lot better than not sitting together at the table, which is has been the case for most of the past 7 years now since Russia annexed Crimea. So yes, Blinken will be able to address, let alone solve these issues next week, but at least he'll be able to bring them up. And I think in particular, Russia's build-up on the Ukrainian border is something he'll address, and the continued US concern about interference. But we should remember that Russia will then say, "Well, you Americans, you interfere in our country too," because from the Russian perspective, it looks like that. Even though what they would call Russian US interference it takes different forms, but even so, Russia does feel that the US and the West interfere in their domestic affairs, and no doubt Lavrov will make that point next week, but at least they'll be sitting at the same table. And hopefully they'll also be able to talk constructively about Arctic issues, because that is a really, really important area and focus of concern at the moment, because there is so much happening in the Arctic.
Explain a little bit more about what is happening in the Arctic.
Well, first of all, climate change, and that will change the Arctic so fundamentally, which is why the Arctic Council, which again may seem like a sleepy organization, all of a sudden is hugely relevant. Climate change will make the Northeast Passage, so that the body of water has primarily been ice until now, north of Russia will become passable not just for icebreakers, but for commercial shipping as well. And that will completely change how shipping travels from Asia to Europe. And that may be a good thing if you like shipping. It's from a climate change perspective, it's terrible that it's happening. So even though we may be able to get our goods faster, the price we pay for that, it's part of a really, really terrible development, which is climate change. Now, when Mike Pompeo participated in a recent Arctic Council meeting, he was all upbeat about the Arctic and how fantastic it is that shipping will be expedited through warming temperatures. That is the only advantage to climate change that I can think of. So the Arctic nations are highly likely to be talking about climate change. They're also highly likely to be talking about trying to find a solution about military buildup in the Arctic that has increased along with climate change and the viability of the Arctic or the attractiveness of the Arctic as a geopolitical area. So there is a lot they have to get through in these very few hours of discussing in Iceland, but it's great that they are getting together and are having able to meet in this relatively small format.
They are getting together, but what is the likelihood of a meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and the US President Joe Biden? I mean, Joe Biden has suggested a meeting in a third country. Vladimir Putin has not responded publicly, at least.
Yes, and I think that was to be expected because they don't want to play a diplomatic game in front of the world's cameras, even though that has been done before. I think it is likely that a meeting will happen. We have to remember that throughout the Cold War, U.S. and Russian leaders met even at the coldest of moments in Cold War history, and we have to remember that Khrushchev was even invited to see real America, which he saw with great delight and marveled at the number of, I think it was cereal brands available in American supermarkets. So there have been meetings regularly during the Cold War, and that's likely to continue despite the obviously very, very noticeable differences and very serious differences between the countries. So I think at this moment it's safe to assume that the diplomacy in getting both leaders to agree on a meeting and getting them to agree on where it should take place and getting that country to agree to host it are probably running at a very high speed already.
Elizabeth Brough, thank you as ever. Still to come on today's programme, as more pandemic restrictions are lifted across the UK, we celebrate the return of the embrace.
Leading neuroscientists have found that human contact, actually physically touching someone else, is vital for our health and happiness.
Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
7:25 here in London. It's time now for a letter from New York City. This week, Henry Reese Sheridan takes stock of the first Democratic mayoral debate.
Last Thursday, there was a debate between the leading Democratic candidates to be mayor of New York City. The debate was completely remote, conducted over teleconferencing software. Nine heads, eight candidates plus a moderator floated next to each other on the screen, each in their own self-contained rectangle. This format robs debate participants of several important avenues of self-expression. The most potent forms of body language are off the table. It's also difficult to get a subtle glance to register when the picture resolution is so low and your head is so tiny. Even if you manage to successfully formulate a subtle glance that cuts through the pixelation, directing it at a particular target is all but impossible. But the remote format does open up at least one new avenue of self-expression for the candidates: their backgrounds. Under normal circumstances, candidates have no control over the physical environment a debate is taking place in. But in a virtual debate, they can position themselves in any environment that they want that has a reasonable Wi-Fi connection. In the debate last Thursday, each of the candidates' backgrounds were unique, but not so unique that they can't be sorted into three main categories. The first category of background is the most simple, the campaign sign. Three candidates, Maya Wiley, Eric Adams, and Scott Stringer, took this approach. Each appeared in front of signs bearing their campaign logos. Scott Stringer and Maya Wiley sat in front of floor-to-ceiling billboards, not unlike the screens emblazoned with sponsorship logos that athletes stand in front of during post-match interviews. In Wiley and Stringer's cells, nothing else was visible except for these screens and their heads. Eric Adams took a more nuanced and curious approach. He sat in what appeared to be an office. It was completely unadorned except for four signs stuck on the wall. These were arranged in two squat columns, with each column made up of two stacked signs. Between these two columns, there was a gap that was precisely the width of Eric Adams's head. Adams positioned his head between the sign columns, so it was framed by them. I still can't decide what to make of this approach. It was quite distracting, but perhaps that was the intention. The benefits of the signage approach are obvious. First, it straightforwardly boosts viewers' familiarity with the candidate's logo, which will appear elsewhere on their campaign materials. Second, it leaves very little room for interpretation. This limits the amount of damage that can be self-inflicted through bad decor choices. In contrast, the second category of background seeks to harness the power of decor choices. It is the domestic setting. A domestic setting approach was taken by Diane Morales, Sean Donovan, and probably Ray Maguire. Morales took the well-trodden path of sitting in front of a shelf full of books and plants. The impression given was a reassuring one of overwhelming middle-class normality. Donovan, on the other hand, was seated in a massive open-plan kitchen slash dining room. It was fancy. Too fancy by half, in my opinion. I don't think ordinary voters will find his massive open-plan kitchen very relatable, especially when you consider that earlier in the week, Donovan underestimated the median sales price of a Brooklyn home by $800,000. The reason I say Ray Maguire only probably took the domestic approach earlier is because he might have been in a homely office rather than a true domestic space. In any case, the dark panelled walls didn't give a lot away. At this stage, it's worth explaining frontrunner Andrew Yang's hybrid setup. For the most part, his environment was domestic. Like Morales, he sat in front of plants and books, also a very nice lamp. So far, so anodyne. But on the wall behind him, someone had tacked up a strip of campaign signs. In other words, Yang had combined the signage and domestic setting approaches, presumably seeking the best of both worlds. I don't mind this approach as long as the signs were taken down the second the debate was over. But if the signs are a permanent fixture of the Yang domestic setting, that's a whole different story. Because who is Yang trying to advertise his campaign to in his own home? His children are far too young to vote. That means he's either trying to promote his bid for mayor to himself or to his wife Evelyn, or both of them at the same time. I'm not sure which of these options is worse. The third category of background is one that Catherine Garcia occupied all by herself. I call it the provincial crematorium waiting room. Garcia sat in front of an unadorned wall painted a soft violet. The room she was in appeared to be completely bare, except for a jar of flowers behind her left shoulder that screamed sincere condolences. There's not much to say about the scene other than it made me extraordinarily depressed, which is a shame because I quite like Garcia as a candidate. The debate itself was quite spirited in spite of the remote format. Andrew Yang was targeted by the rest of the pack, which a frontrunner could only expect. Maya Wiley put on a strong showing that might have boosted her prospects a little bit. But I don't think anything happened that is fundamentally going to change the race. For now, Yang and Adams continue to jostle for the number one spot, with Maya Wiley and Scott Stringer in joint third. The next debate is on June 2nd. Will the city have opened up enough by then to release the heads from their rectangles? Only time will tell.
And my thanks to Henry Reese Sheridan for that in New York. Still to come, a look at the newspapers and we celebrate touching. But first, with the time at 7:32 here in London, a quick summary now of the latest world news headlines. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that further fighting between Israel and Palestine could plunge the region into an uncontainable crisis. More than 40 people were killed in the latest Israeli strikes on Gaza. 10 people have been killed in Israel since the fighting began a week ago. Myanmar's military has entered a small town in western Chin state to put down a rebellion. Mindat is one of several towns where people arm themselves in the wake of a nationwide coup. 800 people have been killed in Myanmar since the army ousted the elected government in February. Taiwan's government has imposed tough new restrictions to control a spike in the country's COVID-19 cases. Authorities are shutting down cinemas and entertainment venues until the end of the month, and gatherings will also be limited. President Tsai Ing-wen has urged people not to panic buy goods. And one of the most ambitious public space proposals in Toronto for several decades has been shelved. Raildeck Park, which would have cost $1.7 billion Canadian dollars, aimed to create a vast new public park above the tracks of Toronto's busiest rail corridor. For more, head to monocle.com/minute. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, today finally sees the relaxing of COVID-related government advice on hugging in England and Scotland. People from different households are no longer advised to keep their distance from one another. For millions, today will be the first time they've touched people outside their support bubble in months. Well, to coincide with our new freedom, an exhibition is opening that will allow the public to touch sculptures made by the artist Henry Moore. Monocle's Alexis Self travelled to Moore's former studios outside London to get hands-on with the sculptor's work.
After a year of awkward greetings, jaunty elbow bumps and back-breaking bows, not to mention long, cold nights, from today, residents of England are legally allowed to hug friends and family again. Leading neuroscientists have found that human contact, actually physically touching someone else, is vital for our health and happiness. On our skin are special touch fibres that are responsible for registering and transmitting the emotional meaning of certain strokes or caresses. One person who knew the power of touch was Henry Moore. The English artist, often revered as the country's greatest ever sculptor, created many works for public settings, housing estates and parks. His intention was that they be experienced physically as well as visually. Touched, stroked, patted, even clambered upon. As his reputation grew and his work increased in value, these same sculptures were placed behind barriers, deemed too precious to touch. Now the potter and writer Edmund Duval has curated an exhibition of Moore's work. Opening on Wednesday, the Living Hand invites the public to run their hands over these beautiful, beguiling objects. I travelled to the Henry Moore Studios in Hertfordshire, just outside London, to touch some art. Before I was let loose on the sculptures, I spoke to Edmund Duval. I started by asking him how the exhibition had come about.
It was a very straightforward idea, which is, we're all used to Henry Moore being kind of grand and public and on plinths everywhere, but actually no one has really done an exhibition which allows you to touch him. I mean, to get your hands involved with his sculptures. And then also to sort of think, where, how does he conceptualize the hand? How does he think about it? How does he draw it? What does he have around him that tells you about his relationship with the hand? So it's a very straightforward proposition. Mm. Henry Moore and the hand.
This is Mother and Child, a sculpture from 1978, made of stalactite. Maybe it makes it look like it's been forced together with such extreme force, and yet it's so smooth and kind of controlled.
Obviously, as you said, many of his sculptures were created for public settings. Was it always his intention for them to be touched?
Well, it's very interesting because there are some very beautiful photographs of sculptures early on, well, in the 1950s and 60s, in sort of shopping centres and, you know, on plazas. And you have pictures of children climbing all over them and lovely kind of moments where it's public and private art coming together. But, of course, what happens is that he becomes the most esteemed artist in the world. He becomes this very grand figure. The work becomes very expensive, and you start to see that the work being taken out of touch, taken away. Of course, in museums, you know, do not touch everywhere, but then outside as well, you start to see railings round things, or the plinths getting higher in some ways. And what you see is that kind of removal of the hand.
This is King and Queen. It was cast in 1985 out of bronze.
But how has your idea of the show changed since then? I mean, you've made this tsukubai, which is a Japanese wash basin for visitors to cleanse their hands before and after touching the sculptures.
But it came to me very strongly that if we wanted to stay true to this idea of touch, after a year in which we had not been able to touch anything without sanitizing, without gloves, PPE, whatever, hadn't been able to touch the people we loved, where every single surface became a place of anxiety, how could you allow people to touch? Came back to this, I think, beautiful idea of these wash spaces that are on the edges of temples and shrines and museums and gardens, and created one. So it's the first time I've ever done it. And this is day one, so I'm going to try and see what people think.
This is a reclining figure from 1979, made of bronze. How does that feel?
Much softer. Not as soft as the mother and the child, but
more
inviting to touch. Also, it's around.
A hierarchy of the senses, so to speak. Yes. I mean, Aristotle spoke of that. And touch is placed last.
Yeah.
Behind sight, hearing, smell and taste.
Yeah.
After a year in which our freedom to touch has been curtailed, does its significance deserve a reappraisal?
Well, you just look at what's happening this week, next week, when people are allowed to hug, I mean, again, or to touch, or to, you know, the reappraisal happens on such an incredibly basic level, which is we need, it's the most extraordinary and profound connection to the world. You're touching someone, it's actually recognising the otherness of someone else. You know, and that's what you want to have that reaffirmed in the world. So damn Aristotle, he can go screw himself. He's wrong.
There you have it. Aristotle was wrong. about the senses. The Living Hand, Edmond Duval presents Henry Moore, is open at the Henry Moore Studios and Gardens in Perry Green, Hertfordshire, from the 19th of May. I'm Alexis Self, reporting for Monocle. Keep in touch, people. Back to you, Emma.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Alexis. The time is 7:40 here in London. Let's continue now with today's newspapers. I'm joined on the line from East London by Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller. A very good morning to you, Andrew.
Good morning.
Who or what are you looking forward to touching today now that restrictions have been lifted?
I don't even know where to start answering that question. I've only just got up. I haven't thought that far ahead. Can we please talk about Australia's and China's trade war instead?
Feel free.
This is a good piece from the ABC talking about how Australian producers, especially Australian rural producers, are adapting to the fact that China has kind of informally sanctioned their product. And it's actually weirdly heartwarming. They have discovered after years of relying on China that other people want to buy Australia's barley and coal as well.
And so just to explain to us, this is in the backdrop of a hugely nasty fallout between China and Australia, isn't it? So people are being forced into a corner, effectively, to try and find business elsewhere.
Well, so China thought, and it does rather appear that at least as far as the producers this piece speaks to, their move has failed, because the recurring theme of the piece is people who were initially worried, as one would be when one biggest customer takes their business elsewhere. But they've discovered that India wants to buy Australian coal, that Saudi Arabia wants to buy Australian barley, and that it turns out that, yes, our wines actually are pretty good and other people want to buy those as well.
And the question is asked in this article on the ABC's website, which is the Australia trade dream over? Are we in a position to say yes yet?
Well, actually, it appears to be one of those observations of the great journalistic trope that if there is a question mark in the headline, then the answer is no. It's kind of heartwarming, really. Adapt and survive appears to be the theme.
Let's move on to another story from the Sydney Morning Herald. Adapting and surviving and leaving Australia.
Well, indeed. This is a report for the Sydney Morning Herald by Latika Burke, who's a reporter of theirs based in London and has been covering this story a lot, which is the effect of Australia's extremely hard lockdown on Australians overseas. And as I've discussed on air a few times, there are many millions of us, myself included, who can't go home and see our family. But there's tens of thousands of Australians who live in Australia who haven't been allowed to go home for more than a year. But this story is making the point that there are now not small numbers of Australians who are in Australia and have been in Australia throughout this, who are now thinking of packing their bags and leaving as soon as that becomes possible. It is estimated by Australia's own government that 177,000 people are planning to go elsewhere, because this idea of Fortress Australia, which I think is actually fairly popular with a lot of people in Australia, is not popular with people who have families abroad, who have work that takes them abroad, and who, you know, would basically rather live in a country which isn't completely isolated.
There's also the issue that there's a deeper, more malign force working here, according to many people, which is the fact that if you are someone who has ended up moving to Australia in the past, you no longer feel welcome.
Yeah, that comes up a few times, which is really, really sad, because I think it is something that, you know, give or take the difficulties that often arise, Australia has actually done pretty well as a place that people can go to and make a new life in. But a big part of that is being able to maintain connections with family overseas, where your family might originally have come from. And the stories collected in this piece are just people who feel like they can't do that anymore, having to spend months and, you know, astonishing sums of money to undertake what would normally be a two-week holiday in America or Europe or wherever else.
Finally, let's talk about, you talk about isolation and Fortress Australia. There's a wonderful story about two people falling in love in the last place you should actually be allowed to fall in love, namely in separate rooms in quarantine.
They do seem to have observed all protocols while doing it, but this is a lovely story in The Age, reminding us that it hasn't been terrible for everybody. And yes, it's a young couple in Melbourne, Vanessa Rokas and Anthony Thomas, who met online in a quarantine hotel in Melbourne while they were staying a floor apart, and they played online Scrabble together, and they watched the same Netflix things at the same time and took bets on whose food would arrive first, and when they eventually met, got on just as well.
It is an absolutely delightful story, given the fact that they were clearly sort of going, falling in love with each other, a matter of meters apart from each other, yet absolutely unable to talk to each other. Given the fact that I think the woman in the relationship said that she suddenly started to get messages from this man. Now, in normal circumstances, I know how I would feel about that, but clearly she was absolutely up for it.
He clearly writes a very good opening message. I mean, I do encourage everybody to read this story on The Age now before this gets turned into an absolutely unbearable film.
Thank you very much indeed to Andrew Muller, Monocle's contributing editor. You're listening to The Globalist. In a moment, film news.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter, to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
7:46 here in London. Let's bring you the latest from the world of cinema now with a film critic and regular Monocle 24 contributor Karen Krasanovich in the studio. Good to see you and back in the cinema tonight.
In the studio and back in the cinema tonight, yes.
What are you seeing tonight? I mean, how excited. You live and breathe the movies.
Yes, unfortunately, because my real life is terrible. No, well, I think Tim Robey said earlier on a Monocle show that he was going to see 2001, and that's what I'm going to see tonight as well. Although there's so much on that, I'm really torn. There's also, I hate to say this, but there's also theater. There's Sadler's Wells is opening tonight as well, and there's, you know, so much to do.
Stuff is booked, stuff is on the way. It is a good thing here in the United Kingdom, at least. Let's look at elsewhere in the world of cinema. The Golden Globes, a big, big problem here.
Yeah, it's gotten quite funny now. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association, there's about 86 members, have really not done themselves any service by starting a ball rolling of sort of corruption. Now, you think corruption in an awards thing, you know, for Hollywood isn't such a big deal, but actually it kind of is, because it hinges on a lot of product placement and a lot of sponsorship, but also charity, etc. I won't go into all of the details because we don't really have time, but Tom Cruise has handed back all three of his Golden Globes, saying he's not going to have anything to do with. We're thinking, like, when did he win those? When was that? Was that recently? And also, Netflix is refusing to work with him until 2023, if things get sorted out. They're not going to be broadcast by NBC. And actually, the Tom Cruise handing back was made fun of on Saturday Night Live this weekend. So you know it's reached peak ridiculousness. Now, the succession of Hollywood Foreign Press, do we need them? There's only, like I said, only 86 members from 55 countries. Might be replaced by, who do we like to see? Actors.
How wonderful. I mean, the charge levied against the Hollywood Foreign Press Association was that they'd had no one who was black as a member for, what, two decades?
Yes. They also have membership every month, which is, you know.
So what exactly does this mean for the future of the Golden Globes? Because they are stitched into the calendar, aren't they, when it comes to sort of like handing out awards. And the award season itself, would fundamentally have to change.
Well, I think they probably would. I mean, the festivals, for example, move around quite a bit. Awards can shift a little bit. But the Hollywood Foreign Press for a long time, the Golden Globes, were considered a forerunner to the Oscars. Now, not so much now, but there is some talk that the SAG Awards will replace them. That's the Screen Actors Guild. And that's been around since, it's had an announcement in 1995 is when it first started doing actual visual announcing. But it's been around since 1953, and the Golden Globes have been around since the 40s. So you really, they're almost comparable. It's just absolutely wonderful about the SAGs, because they're very relaxed and they're all actors. And people just feel that it's not weird. There's a reason why we're watching this, whereas the Golden Globes were there initially to get more information from Hollywood out to international, you know, journals and magazines and newspapers.
Let's move on to the we're looking about the reopening of cinemas here in the United Kingdom, at least. Every time I speak to you or hear from you, you say no COVID case has been linked to a cinema, but then you just sort of like finish that off with, but they've all been closed.
They have been closed.
But what's going to happen to our film watching habits, given the fact that, I'll be absolutely upfront with this, I've seen far more movies in the last year than I think I have done in my entire life, simply because I quite like my sofa. I quite like being able to go to the fridge. I quite like being able to just not be in a cinema. It's also a little better value, one would argue.
Yes.
Are we going to, what is going to happen to our cinemas and our filmmaking and our film watching habits?
You see, I've kept a bad sofa for just that reason. What's going to happen is people are going to be looking at their subscription services and thinking, okay, how much value am I getting? That's £30 maybe for these, but it's £30 to go to the cinema. But can I ask you, how many Netflix moments, how many memorable moments with your family can you recount watching Netflix?
I wonder whether we're now going to get two different sorts of films. The films that you need to go and see on the big screen and the films that you perhaps don't.
You definitely will. I mean, for example, people that have seen Nomadland, for example, are now wanting to see it on the big screen because it's a big screen movie. Also, seeing it with a bunch of people. Now, I know we're still in sort of post-COVID or COVID situation, but still seeing it in a group. It's the reason why people go to sports events. To have that communal feeling, I think, is very important. And also, it's an enormous screen and you can't get up and answer the phone in the middle. Well, you can, but I will yell at you if you do that.
And just very quickly, I mean, is the cinema world worried about this, that people are going to go to small?
Yes, there is a concern. There is a concern about streaming because ultimately studios are looking at the bottom line as opposed to what movies are being released. But I think for the time being, two of them are going to coexist, and I think one is going to be an event and the other one is going to be convenience.
Karen Krasanovich, thank you as ever for joining us back in the studio here on Monocle 24. The final of the 65th edition of the Eurovision Song Contest is happening this Saturday in Rotterdam after the contest was forced on a year-long break due to COVID. All this week here on The Globalist, we are bringing you a special series. And to kick things off, Fernando Augusto Pacheco heads to Lithuania to meet the band The Roop, who could be in a chance with winning. Let's have a listen.
I'm a human, not a stone. I can make a change and go wherever I want to. They told me maybe I'm too old, but there's fire in my soul. The heat is getting higher. I feel that I'm on fire. The world is my desire. I feel that I'm on fire.
Yeah. I feel that sometimes there is an opinion that if you are in Eurovision, so you must be like sing Eurovision-ish song. Yeah, so it's not, it seems like it's a different bubble from real normal mainstream music, radio music. So we say no to this and we want to unite this and to show to the world that Eurovision is a good platform to show your real music and to spread the message.
And one thing that I think you guys have, you're three very stylish men. I mean, I think even the looks and the kind of the sharpness of the choreography, I think it's really kind of vibrant in a way. I think it really helps. And I have to say, you guys look good in yellow. It's my favorite color as well.
Yeah, really? Oh, great. Oh,
cool. What's the plan for this year? I mean, of course, we don't know everything, but are you guys going to Holland, the artist? You know, I know it's going to be a bit different. Perhaps the audience in the arena is not going to be fully packed like in previous years. But what do you guys know already about Eurovision?
Yeah, we hope to reach Rotterdam. That's it for me. You know, I just want to go on that stage to sing, to dance, feel good. This is it, because it is our plan. we must be 100% prepared.
Ready, yeah.
Ready.
So now we're thinking about getting ready and be, you know, 120% prepared for the for our performance and deliver it. Yeah, not thinking too much about audience or things like that. That's gonna be there, that's fine.
You know, the main audience will be sitting in front of
TVs. Yeah,
of TVs. Exactly. Yeah, so we want to share our message and our music to them.
And one thing I would like to ask as well, I mean, to be honest, I don't know much about the Lithuanian music scene, but the few artists that I know, I mean, it's quite a strong kind of dance electronic scene. And I know you guys, I don't know how to define dance rock, I don't know, whatever you guys want to define yourselves, but is that quite strong in Lithuania? Because there's quite a lot of kind of DJs coming out. I mean, you guys have quite a big kind of electronic beat in the background as well.
Yeah, I would say yes. This scene is really strong. We have several really great bands that are really loved and huge in Lithuania, like Solo Ensemblis, for example. They are kind of up dance rock, maybe more to the electronic side than we are.
Bass Soul and Anus.
Yeah.
And many others, you know.
And many others. Yeah, just to answer generally, I think, yeah, this scene is really strong in Lithuania. I don't know if we can define ourselves as dance rock, maybe. Yeah, I usually don't want to... I would, you know, refrain from trying to put, you know, ourselves in music style or any other band into a music style. So
you're right. I mean, it's very hard defining a band and their sound these days. I find it very confusing because, you know, there's such a mix of genres and everything. But, yes. You know, guys, I wish all the best for you because I want Lithuania to win as well. And I want to visit Lithuania for the first time. A final question. Do you guys, you know, like any of the songs this year?
Yes, we do.
There are a few, yeah.
Yes. Daddy Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me too.
Me three.
Me three. Yeah. What else? You want to name it?
Yeah, I'm into a little bit of heavier music, so Italy and Finland to me this year are, you know, the thing.
Okay. So, but it's his opinion.
That's my opinion.
And I also like Switzerland.
Oh, yeah.
John Stiers or Gjorms?
Should be John Stiers. I don't know.
I don't know. Gjorms. Some say
how
John.
How to pronounce. Yeah.
But I like.
And that was The Roop. They're representing Lithuania in this year's Eurovision Song Contest. Tune in tomorrow for part two of our series on Eurovision. And that's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Rhys James, Carlotta Ribello, Alexis Self and Charlie Filmacourt, and our studio manager, Christy Evans, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu and Sean Hickey. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday here in London and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you for listening and have a great week. We'll